дерзкого убийства Бориса Немцова прошло чуть более недели.
Кто убил Немцова и где же мистер Путин? Эти журналисты с ног сбились в поисках.
Глава Чечни Рамзан Кадыров дал свои комментарии.
Бориса Немцова, говорит глава Чечни, и то, что связывает это дело с именем Чечни.
Немцова убили не иначе, как по указке российских властей.
Он заявил о верности родине и верховному главнокомандующему президенту России Владимиру Путину.
Three weeks that shook the Kremlin. An opposition leader is slain. A president goes AWOL. And his underlings go for each other's throats. And at the center of all this were two pillars of Vladimir Putin's autocratic regime, the vaunted Siliviki and the Kremlin's hand-picked Chechen leader, Ramzan Kadyrov. Veteran Kremlin watcher Edward Lucas told Britain's ITV News this week that, quote, we're seeing the rivets popping inside the Kremlin in a way we haven't seen before. We are indeed, and there are some pretty big rivets. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio, where he is visiting on official business and performing without the benefits of a Skype line, is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks very much. Great to be here in the flesh.
Good to see you in the flesh. Well, it's just us today, and there's plenty to talk about. So let's start with something you wrote last week. When Putin was still on the lam, and Kremlin watchers were all in a flutter about coup rumors, myself included to a degree, your headline said it all, no coups today. You were right, as you often are. But nonetheless, something seriously wrong in Moscow. The Nemtsov assassination seems to have unleashed something that is causing a lot of people, not least of all the Siloviki, to act out a bit. Would you agree that something is wrong right now in Moscow?
Something is wrong. I think there's a danger in making too much of it. I mean, just as we did with the whole sort of, is Putin dead? Has there been a coup or whatever type furore? Likewise, I don't think that we're seeing some catastrophic collision taking place within the elite. Instead, I think what we're seeing is that, and we've seen this in the past as well, when the regime gets weaker, when the regime comes under strain, we tend to find, first of all, that its ability to quickly and easily control tensions within the apparat get reduced. And secondly, that you tend to get more competition between the various agencies. We must realize this is a very, very disaggregated, fragmented, fractious, and competitive elite, even within the security apparatus, let alone amongst anyone else. So, I mean, I think what this actually shows is that, you know, we can expect, just as there have in the past been conflicts between different elements, including between the FSB and Kadyrov, there's clearly no love there. But at a time when, as it were, the system is that much weaker, it becomes more visible, more quickly, potentially more serious, and it'll take more political resource to quickly deal with it.
Do you think the Nemtsov assassination was the trigger here?
I think it's not the trigger for the debilitation of the regime. I think that's something that has been taking place a bit longer, in part because of the obvious blunder that was the move into southeastern Ukraine, coupled with the real concerns about the economic crisis that is gripping Russia and will continue to grip. I think this is the thing, you know, it is clear that although the Kremlin's economic strategy is to cross its fingers, close its eyes and hope the oil price goes up, there's a lot of people who are realizing this is not actually a sensible strategy. So I think this is why you've got them getting real pressures and real concerns about the leadership and, more to the point, lateral pressures as individuals and institutions compete for shrinking budgets.
Right. Now, what do you see going on in the Siloviki, though? Because, I mean, I just wrote a blog on this week. The FSB and Kadyrov are kind of going at each other. The FSB clearly seems to be trying to pin the Nemtsov assassination on Kadyrov's people. You have competing narratives based on leaks in the media, so it's very unclear to see what's going on. Some saying this was a contract killing, some saying it was a hate crime, then it was motivated by the the Charlie Hebdo tragedy and so on. What do you see going on between Kadyrov and the FSB right now?
I mean, let's start with the inevitable disclaimer that clearly, when it comes down to it, we don't know.
We don't know.
Yeah. So this is all about supposition based on how we read the data
and on external data points.
But even then, I mean, it is sort of subject to the game of, you know, we dot to dot and create the picture that we expect to see often. Now, we know that the FSB and Kadyrov have locked horns in the past. The bottom line is actually no one really likes Kadyrov except maybe Putin.
And Surkov.
Well, yes. We assume, though, with Surkov, who knows? I mean, one wonders
I remember if any portion of story. Remember when Kadyrov came to Surkov's rescue in his time of distress, when Surkov was fired? He popped up a couple days later in Chechnya fishing with Kadyrov. Clear, we're going to talk a little bit about the mafia metaphor in the second half of the podcast, but that was a clear kind of signal. This is what I got, so don't mess with me. That's at least how I interpreted those images of the two fishing when they were posted online.
Yeah, we shouldn't assume, though, that dependence equals friendship.
Mm.
I think that, you know, when it comes down to it, Kadyrov really doesn't have friends in Moscow. The Interior Ministry are deeply distrustful of him because he's been so effective in essentially ensuring that the Chechen Interior Ministry is insulated from the Central Interior Ministry in Moscow. Very, very clear that he wasn't going to willing to allow a chief of police to be parachuted in. And there's a flip side to that. Yes, it means that Kadyrov has his own little encapsulated interior ministry. I mean, let's face it, Chechnya is his personal kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means that he actually has no real connection with the central MVD apparatus. Likewise, the FSB, deeply mistrustful, not so much because of real security concerns, but they don't like the fact that essentially Chechnya is in many ways an FSB-free zone, or rather it's only his own tame spooks.
Right.
And one can continue through all the various apparatuses. No one really likes Kadyrov because Kadyrov is so clearly intent on creating his own personal empire. So in that context, I mean, yes, of course, the FSB is going to leap at the opportunity, any opportunity, and has in the past, of undermining Kadyrov. I don't think they honestly expect to bring him down, because if nothing else, that would create a huge mess in Chechnya. But on the other hand, this is a really good opportunity to score some serious points. Because even if, I mean, we were talking off mic before, and we both see no real sort of credibility in the whole "it was all because of Charlie Hebdo" story. But for me, that was, as it were, the fallback. If Putin is not willing to allow Kadyrov ultimately to be fingered for the killing, or Kadyrov's closest, then they'll say it was because of Charlie Hebdo and such like. And it still counts as a blow against Kadyrov, because it's saying, look, even the people closest to Kadyrov, whom Kadyrov himself defends, are clearly manic jihadists who will come and spread blood on the streets of Moscow. So it's another sign of why Kadyrov isn't quite as effective in keeping the lid on. So from their point of view, they're making hay.
Right. Now, you mentioned that Chechnya is essentially an FSB-free zone, and I can't help but recall the incident back in May 2007, when, if you recall, a group of Kadyrov's armed men, well, this is just months after he was appointed president of Chechnya, at the age of 30, a bunch of his armed men wanted to enter the FSB headquarters. The FSB would not let them in, and then Kadyrov had the entrances and exits to the building welded shut. The crisis was only resolved after Nikolai Patrushev, who was at the time head of the FSB, personally intervened. And Kadyrov was never wrapped on the knuckles for that incident at all. And in fact, quite the opposite. He was able to turn Chechnya into an FSB-free zone. So you don't see any, I mean, why did the FSB choose to go after him now? And the unsaid thing below all of this is whether we believe Kadyrov did this or not, or if he's being set up for it. I guess we probably have to tackle that one first, and it's speculation and supposition and everything. But what does your gut tell you on whether Kadyrov was truly involved in this?
I've always thought that it was essentially some kind of non-direct state agency. Now, at first, my assumption was maybe it was ultra-nationalists working with elements within the security apparatus. I think now, more and more, the evidence, and even trying to read behind what evidence means when it's presented by Russian authorities, actually does point towards Kadyrov. Not least because, quite frankly, the FSB is making no particular secret of what it's doing. And I think it would just be a very dangerous and unexpected step for it to be just trying to frame Kadyrov on no basis whatsoever. So actually, I mean, I think that we are in a situation in which either Kadyrov said, kill me Nemtsov, which would not be, let's face it, out of character. I mean, it's fairly obvious that Kadyrov, for example, had Ruslan Yamadayev murdered in Moscow,
but
too.
But Boris Nemtsov is not Ruslan Yamadayev.
Well, I mean, in some ways, actually, I mean, Ruslan Yamadayev, who was, after all, you know, one of the rival Chechen warlords, who Kadyrov wasn't willing to let the Yamadayev brothers survive as a counterpoint. But the point is, Ruslan Yamadayev, I mean, he was working for the GRU, for military intelligence. Mm-hmm. The Yamadayevs were in charge of a military unit which had explicitly been built to provide some kind of a counterweight to the Kadyrovtsi and so forth. So in some ways, I mean, I think actually killing Yamadayev was in some ways, I would say, even more of a challenge to the state.
Yes and no. I mean, because the way this is going to be viewed broadly is Yamadayev, Kadyrov kills Yamadayev. That's a Chechen razborka. But kill Nemtsov, a national level opposition politician who was once a former first deputy prime minister, who was once seen as a potential successor to Boris Yeltsin, somebody who was personally acquainted with many foreign heads of state. That's going to make more noise.
Certainly going to make more noise. But we have to assume, first of all, that there is a danger in making Kadyrov more sophisticated than he is, which I think is about the most polite way I can think of calling someone
dim.
Man of, well, I mean, he clearly is wily. He clearly doesn't, you know, has his capacities or whatever, but this is a man of relatively low impulse control, and I don't think an especially subtle sense of the outside world outside of Chechnya. So I'm not quite sure if he necessarily would have seen the distinctions between them. But secondly, I think each time, I mean, the reason I sort of dwell on Yamadayev's murder, which is, after all, only one, I mean, he had all the Yamadayevs eliminated, is the fact that he's already demonstrated, in my opinion, that he's willing to kill in Moscow, which is, I think, quite an important thing. It's a different, you know, it's one thing if it's a razborka, settling of scores on your own turf, but this was in central Moscow. And secondly, this is a man who was clearly, basically had been set up by the state to be a counterweight to him. So by killing him, you're actually saying to the state, no. You don't get to do that. So I think that was also a challenge to the state. And he got away with it without any trouble whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So again, I think in this respect, actually, the Kremlin is reaping what it sowed.
So your assumption is that Kadyrov...
Yeah. I mean, the most innocent way one can spin it is that they decided to do it, but then Kadyrov decided retrospectively to bless them for it because he then went and very publicly praised Dadaev, the presumed... person involved. But one way or the other, I do definitely think we can see Kadyrov's fingerprints here.
Now, how do you interpret Kadyrov's behavior? Because he publicly praised Dadaev, and the line the FSB appears to be trying to draw here seems to be going from Dadaev to Adam Dilimhanov, State Duma deputy, Kadyrov's cousin and close associate, to Kadyrov himself. Now, Dilimhanov and Kadyrov have not been mentioned in any official, but the connection is clearly the connection if you look at the press leaks. And it's interesting, all the leaks that are popping up in Novaya Gazeta, the FSB leaking to Novaya Gazeta, fingering Kadyrov. Now, Novaya Gazeta, I expect to be receptive to this because they still got to be pretty angry about their journalist Anna Politkovskaya being killed. I mean, everybody, the prime suspect there for ordering that was Kadyrov. But they're trying to draw this line. Kadyrov seemed to have sensed this in the very early, but you have a series of odd behaviors from him, and the bar for odd behavior from Kadyrov is pretty damn high, but you had a series of odd things. First, he praises Dadaev publicly, which, what does he do? He associates himself immediately. People wouldn't have made the connection unless they're people that really follow the caucuses closely from Dadaev to Kadyrov until Kadyrov made this comment. And then you see, Dadaev was the deputy commander of Battalion Sever, which was the, you know, part of the legendary Kadyrovtsi, the forces that are loyal to Kadyrov in Chechnya, that Kadyrov personally formed. So he first he draws attention to the fact that he's associated to this guy. Then he goes to a shooting range and pops off a few rounds and posts it on Instagram, which is his favorite method of communication these days. And then he writes that bizarro love letter to Putin. You know, that I will lay down my life for you and be loyal to you, even if you're not the president. How do you interpret Kadyrov's behavior as this is unfolding, as the FSB appears to be trying to make a case that points to Kadyrov? He was almost like he was helping them in their job here.
Well, I think it reflects that, first of all, Kadyrov regards himself as pretty much bulletproof. So in some ways, his way of killing the story is to put himself in front of it. You know, it's more or less, are you really wanting to pick this fight, is basically what he's saying. Second element is, look, I mean, it does seem likely that Dadaev was quite possibly acting under orders. Indeed, Dadaev's superior is another one of the Delimkhanovs in charge of Batalion Sever. So this is all very sort of closely linked.
Aslanbek Delimkhanov, yeah. Yeah.
So that, given that, you know, we are talking about, hesitate to say this because I don't want to sort of fall into sort of cheap cultural stereotyping, but nonetheless, you know, very much Kadyrov has built the Kadyrovtsy around personal loyalties. They swear an oath to him, not to the Chechen state. Now, from that point of view, it would be incredibly toxic for him to just basically ditch this person and just simply say, I never heard of him before, or whatever. He has to demonstrate personal loyalty. That is the flip side. If he expects personal loyalty from these people, he has to demonstrate it as well. So, I mean, I think he was in a position where he couldn't just simply cut Dadaev loose. So instead, he was basically making himself the issue precisely to basically to try and kill this story, rather than allow the FSB to incrementally and subtly creep it closer and closer to him.
Uh-huh. All right. Then, after doing this, why go to the shooting range? And I mean, what was that all about? I mean, that was right on the heels of it.
I think this is still part of Kadyrov's. I mean, on the one hand, he shows that he is a vital and mighty figure. And the second time, he makes this sort of comment about his personal loyalty to Putin. But with this fascinating, regardless of whether or not you're president, which, I mean, again, there's a danger in reading too much into this.
This happened as Putin was missing, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost a sort of case of, you know, whatever happens, you know that you can trust me, possibly with an element of, but you might not be president. The whole,
and
you know,
an
remember
implicit
your only
threat, I'm loyal, but others may not be.
Yeah, exactly. As I said, I mean, you know, I don't want to read too much into it in the sense of one mustn't assume excessive subtlety. I think this is very clearly, this is a man who was more or less saying, you know, Dadaev is my guy. If you go after Dadaev, you are
after
going
me.
After me. And bear in mind that I am powerful and strong. I'm the sort of person who fights. But also, Vladimir, remember, I'm your guy. Do you really want to do anything against me?
Right. And what do you make of the battle of leaks that was going on? Because you saw leaks and counter leaks. This was a contract killing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a contract killing. What did you? And leaks that seemed to point in the direction of Delimkhanov, that the stuff that was not coming out in the official investigation. What did you? But then there were counter leaks that this was, you know, the Charlie Hebdo motive was the main thing. What did you make of that?
I'd suggest two things. One is, again, that it's the FSB fighting this particular battle in their terms. I mean, you know, Kadyrov has his particular idiom. The FSB have theirs, which is often precisely a battle of leaks and creating sort of the basis for subsequent allegations and so forth. But the second thing is, I mean, I do think that there's an element of preparing potential fallbacks. I don't believe for a minute that the FSB thinks that ultimately they're going to bring down Kadyrov. I don't even know if they'd want to, given the potential mess that then they'd have to deal with actually in Chechnya. They want to knock him down a few pegs, show him that, in fact, he's a big fish in a distant pond rather than being a Moscow mover and shaker. The Charlie Hebdo story, therefore, allows that. It allows them to say, oh, well, this is what it was about. You know, Kadyrov, like all these flighty Caucasus folk, sort of sprang to the defence We can't blame him for that. It's just his hot blood. But when it comes down to it, this was just a handful of jihadist conspirators. Mm-hmm. End of story.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kadyrov got no less than 3 state medals mm-hmm. over a 9-day period, right in the middle of all of this. Right, he got the highest state medal you can award in Russia, but. I mean, he got 2 more, one from the Russian authorities in an ex-Crimea and one from the funny enough, from the state penitentiary service. But what did you make of that, this spate of medals? Because I interpreted that as somebody's basically saying, don't touch Kadyrov. That was how I interpreted that.
Yeah, it might be don't touch Kadyrov, or it
wasn't
might
a
be
coincidence like Peskov said.
Of course
said.
Not. No, no, exactly. No, it was either a don't touch Kadyrov or it was a way of basically buying off Kadyrov, who may well have been exceedingly angry that he was being targeted. He may well be thinking, well, I got rid of this pesky Nemtsov. Why are people now targeting me? And it's a way of basically buying him off with baubles and trinkets.
Do you think he's that buyable off with trinkets?
We've all seen the YouTube shots of his motorcade. We've seen the photos of his personal zoo. I think if anyone can be bought off with baubles and trinkets, it's Ramzan. I'm not planning on going to Chechnya any day
soon. I hope not. Let's shift the focus now to Putin, because while all this was going on, as we all know, Putin was absent. Now, one of the ways I was interpreting this absence was that he was being forced to choose between 2 very important pillars of his regime, his FSB, his old agency, the main Siloviki Vyedomosti, and Kadyrov, the man who brought stability to Chechnya, for better or worse, and that he counts on to keep Chechnya stable, that he was kind of caught in between those two, and that's a very tough call to make. What was your interpretation of Putin's absence before we get into the rest?
Honestly, I suspect it was still a health issue, that basically, for that reason, he didn't want to be seen. On the one hand, look, I agree entirely that Putin finds himself in this position in a tight spot. He needs the FSB for Russia. He needs Kadyrov for Chechnya. I mean, I would dearly love to see Kadyrov toppled. But the point is, Putin, and it's something that we've encountered in the past, Putin is not one to make hard decisions. Putin really likes to make decisions only when he knows that he's got the best possible and the safest possible outcome and answer. Sometimes he's wrong about that, as we've seen in the Donbass, but nonetheless, I think he thinks that these are going to be straightforward things, and he tries to tend to duck difficult decisions. So this could have been an attempt to duck it, but let's be honest. Firstly, it was handled phenomenally badly, if it was an actual strategic decision to do so. Secondly, actually, him just simply disappearing out of circulation does not make that dilemma go away. He ultimately needs to resolve it. It's not something that will just
organically
disappear.
No, my feeling was he
was
trying to resolve it. Because, you know, Kadyrov went missing for a few days in the middle of this period as well. This was noticed in Chechnya that he was. And now it's come out since that during Putin's absence, he had met with Kadyrov. Mm-hmm. That's come out. So I'm wondering if Putin and Kadyrov hadn't sat down and hashed things out.
I just don't feel that Putin needs to disappear for 10 days.
To meet Kadyrov?
To meet Kadyrov. I mean, you know, especially since Kadyrov was only there for 2 days. You know, obviously there was stuff going on, of course, because this is a serious, shall we say, Silovik constitutional challenge, an issue. Mm-hmm. And in part, I think it's also that, therefore, Kadyrov needs, I think from the FSB's point of view, needed also to have been told, look, you don't do this in Moscow. Mm. Moscow is not your playground.
And Putin, you think Putin had to tell him?
I would imagine.
Him. Nobody else but Putin could tell
exactly.
him.
Exactly. I think no one but Putin could tell him that. And likewise, Kadyrov had to have his chance and his stay and to anyway be reassured, and hence we have the medals and baubles.
Right.
It's not so much to signal to others, because I think there are other ways of doing that, but to signal to Kadyrov, look, actually, genuinely, we do still love you.
Mm-hmm. But just behave yourself a little bit mm-hmm. better. Now, how diminished is Putin from this whole escapade? Because no matter what it was, whether it was illness, whether it was settling this fight between his most trusted lieutenants, he didn't come out of this looking great. I mean, how diminished do you think he is as a result of all of this?
I mean, I think he is diminished. I think this is both a cause and effect, though. On the one hand, he is diminished because, I mean, either he was ill or he was hiding or something, but nonetheless, this absence was very badly handled. And the fact that you have, just as with the 2007 Silovik War, actually divisions amongst the Siloviki reflects badly on him as the sort of the godfather of the Siloviki. Right. So this is diminishing, but I think in many ways also this is a symptom of a diminution that has been taking place as members of the elite begin to think that he made a blunder over Ukraine. They are worried about the outcomes of the economic crisis and the fact that there is no real economic policy to respond to it. So in some ways, it's precisely because Putin is already a bit smaller than he was that I think we see this crisis emerging and become such a big issue that it wasn't one that he could deal with quickly and with determination. So I think we are seeing the incredible shrinking Putin. Bit by bit, he is becoming smaller. And as he becomes smaller, more crises will emerge, which will in due course shrink
him
further.
Making smaller and smaller, yeah. But you think it was a health issue at the end of the day?
I mean, it's difficult.
He looked awful. I mean, when you looked at that video, I mean, he looked waxy. He looked puffy. He didn't look so sure of himself. I mean, there was not the sardonic remarks you usually get from Putin, except for the life would be boring without rumors. Well, on the Putin Richter scale, that's nothing. I expected if he showed up, it was going to be all cocky and he thought rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated or something along those lines. He looked uncomfortable. It was strange.
Yeah, I mean. I obviously don't know about his health issues, but I think what one can do is think of the alternatives. Okay, let's rule out the baby in Switzerland rumour, if nothing else, because otherwise, I mean, quite how he would have got there without anyone noticing is another matter. This is not a man to travel with one bodyguard or something like that. Or else he was simply hiding, in which case that would be particularly sort of pathetic or a little sort of rerun of Ivan the Terrible's disappearance off to the monastery to wait to be sort of summoned back by a plaintive aristocracy. But again, in that case, we would expect him, if anything, to look particularly tanned and healthy because he'd have had sort of 10 days of good swimming time. Or if it was some kind of health issue, maybe a resurgence of his back problem, firstly, that might explain why he wants to be out of sight, if it was something that clearly visibly so. Because we know that not only does he have enormous personal vanity about his physical condition, it is an integral part of his political persona. And that ought to explain why it was clearly not just sort of badly handled, but handled in a way they clearly didn't have a clear sense of when it was going to end. I don't think they knew quite when he was going to be reappearing. They thought that the Monday was going to be okay, but I don't think they knew it for certain.
But for a Kremlin that has been in the past so skilled at image manipulation, I mean, God, did they bungle this? I mean, they're putting those photos out that were so obviously fake, or not fake, but at least of easily noticeable, you know, the one with the calendar on the desk, for God's sakes. I mean, you know, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that was on a different date. How do you account for the Kremlin just not being ready to handle this?
I mean, I think that it's clear that there has been a genuine decay in the Kremlin's ability to manage the drama, the theatre. But I think also
they looked like masters throughout the whole Ukraine thing. They were running rings around everybody. They can't handle this.
Well, except the thing is, how do they handle Ukraine? On the whole, they handle Ukraine by throwing out lots and lots of other stories, by basically the chaff version to scramble the ray. I mean, this is not one that they could not suddenly approach this by throwing out 10 more different rumours about why Putin was invisible.
Right.
I mean, this is actually something where they were trying to explain away a fact, which is clearly an observable fact, and that's not something that their propaganda machine is really geared for. But what we must note is that all this propaganda, I mean, this was basically for us and the relative handful of Russians who basically get their news through the internet or whatever. If you are an ordinary Russian who's just watching Pervy Kanal, you didn't hear any of this. So in that respect, actually,
it was for the elite, too, because the elite was jittery. And another thing, and Lilia Shevtsova pointed this out in a piece in American Interest, an excellent piece in American Interest this week, that the elite just didn't really suddenly know what to do. They were like they were lost at sea. You heard very few statements coming out from anybody in the government, for example. Medvedev was silent throughout this whole thing. Shoigu, you didn't hear anything.
But if we look at how they communicate with the elite, they haven't been good at this in the past. What they're good at is communicating a party line. when they actually want to say, no, this is what's going to happen. But actually communicating, and perhaps most importantly of all, winning over the elite, is something that they have been failing to do for a long time. I mean, one could just look at the whole naturalization of resources campaign. You must bring all your money home.
Right.
Whereas, in fact, we see capital flight spiking.
Right.
I mean, I think, again, this is in so many ways an excellent case study of what's been going on rather than actually a cause of anything.
Right. Now, I would also add, and this may buttress your health argument. I mean, this is not the first time Putin's been kind of looked weird and awkward in public. Remember the press conference after the first Minsk agreement, when he came out late at night and he was gesturing in a weird way and looked really uncomfortable. He was swaying. The video was quickly taken down from state television's website. But I watched it over and over again, and this was strange. So there's a little bit of history behind sure. this that suggests all is not well with the man. Before we move on to the second half, one more thing I wanted to touch on is, where would you put this, what we just witnessed over the last 3 weeks, on the Richter scale of things that have shaken this regime? I mean, we've had various things. You had the blip of the Siloviki War back in 2007. You had the blip of the would Medvedev stay as president or not? And you had some rumbles in the elite then. You had the Bolotnaya demonstrations of 2011, 2012. And now you have this. Where would you put this on the Richter scale of damage to the regime?
Oh dear, I'd love to be able to give you a nice straightforward answer, but let me actually sort of convert it to a different image, a way of looking at it. Think of two tracks. One is essentially how united and comfortable the elite is, and the other one is how controlled or happy society is. And so long as, in a way, the pressure is only on one of those two tracks, things go okay. 2007 Silovik War. That was definitely an elite issue. Society was fairly quiescent. Then at the time of the castling, you had considerable disquiet within the elite, but society was relatively sort of comfortable with what. Then when you had Bolotnaya, well, you still had some disquiet within the elite, but pretty much by that point, I think they'd come to terms with the situation and they realized that nothing really could be done.
They didn't like it.
But... exactly, but it was no great deal. But on the other hand, this is where you actually had the real sort of beginnings of societal resistance, at least within the main cities. Now, though, we have a situation in which, on the one hand, you have an elite that is clearly increasingly dismayed and divided, especially because of the economic crisis and the sort of the growing tensions with the West, and also the beginnings, I think I would suggest, of signs of pressure within society because of, again, the economic crisis. So this is, I think, what's really different now. So we're not yet at an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I mean, I really don't
think... No, because Putin's popularity is still relatively
precisely.
High. Precisely. It's in the 80s.
Well, on the other hand, though, if you look at the surveys as to how comfortable people are with where the country is now and where it's going, we're seeing a very different picture, increasing dismay.
And this is where the diminishing Putin comes into effect, because Putin's been able to kind of float above public opinion. His personal rating is not related to how people feel about where the country's going. He's been able to just kind of float above all of this. But at some point, if he becomes diminished, then he's not going to be able to do that anymore. Perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. And it means that we may well see that I still think that in the next 12 months, labor unrest might be one of the big stories that emerge, not directly linked to any opposition. And if that happens at a time when the elite is divided, especially the regional elite, that would become much more of a problem to deal with.
Right, and that can be the explosive situation we've been predicting for years. But
then you can ask me about earthquakes.
Then I can ask you about earthquakes. All right, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at why a cliche about Russia, popular in the 1990s, may become more relevant now. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in our studio in Prague is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care.
That, of course, is music from Goodfellas. Back in the 1990s, Goodfellas jokes were very popular among journalists working in Russia, and for good reason. Public assassinations were common. Contract hits were a popular method of resolving political and business disputes. Everybody doing business had to have a krisha or some gangster they were paying protection to. Martin Scorsese's popular 1990 gangster flick seemed an apt metaphor. But here's the thing. If Boris Yeltsin's Russia was indeed a mafia masquerading as a country, it was a mafia run by a weak, feeble, and let's face it, often inebriated godfather. And this gave Yeltsin's underbosses a lot of leeway, which they pretty much used with impunity. When Putin came to power, he pulled off the functional equivalent of uniting New York's five families. The mafia metaphor, I believe, is still apt. But it was a mafia with a strong godfather and pliant, loyal underbosses. And one of the prime commandments was, thou shalt not kill other members of the elite, even those who are in opposition, at least not without the godfather's permission. The Nemtsov assassination seems to have broken those rules and makes me wonder if Goodfellas is coming back, if those old Goodfellas jokes are going to become popular again. Mark, I know the only thing you love talking more about than spies and is gangsters, particularly Russian gangsters. I blogged this a couple of weeks back. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, because I think this metaphor has some legs. Is Goodfellas back in Russia?
Well, this is a chance for me to get my full academic pedant hat on. The interesting thing for me, and yes, I think there are definitely parallels, but it's, as it were, organized crime as it really operates rather than the cliche, the metaphor, which we see in the movies. In the films, there is a godfather and there is this disciplined pyramid of people who obey orders or else.
Until there's a gang war.
Until it's a gang war. But if you actually look at how organized crime really tends to operate, first of all, there is no honor among thieves. That's an absolute myth. Instead, organized crime groupings are held together, first of all, by mutual advantage. That basically they do better within the group than they would do without the group. And the group survives so long as they see the mutual advantage. Hence the obvious immediate parallel with how the elite in Russia might well be feeling this way. Secondly, that there has to be some kind of common cultural identity. They have to understand each other. Because often organized crime, they're not going to spell things out. They have to have codes. They have to have ways of defining things. And the interesting thing here is Kadyrov comes from a very different culture and tradition. Just as actually one can look at differences between the Slavic gangs in Russia and the Caucasus gangs. Mm-hmm. So again, I think in part of the problem that has arisen, or part of the reason behind the Nemtsov killing, is in a way that Kadyrov's notions of, shall I say, the etiquette of violence is different from those of the metropolitan Muscovite, predominantly Slavic sort of bosses.
Talking about real gangsters now, or are we talking about the state metaphor?
Well, the state metaphor, but then again, to be honest, the dividing line is often very, very hazy. But two other points I'd make. One is about the fact that, like organized crime, the state also realizes that basically wars are bad for business. Gang wars are bad for business. And actually, organized crime groups evolve a surprisingly effective array of ways of trying to prevent them. They have their etiquette of the sit-down or the skodka, in Russian terms, because they want to avoid them. When they happen, it's because of a crisis. Mm-hmm. When they happen, it's precisely because the underworld is under extreme pressure and groups are breaking, people are questioning the leadership, or the leadership is weak. So again, I think we can use it to read something in. And the final point I'd make is about structure. We are actually seeing in the global underworld a shift away from the old traditional pyramid model of a boss and underbosses and so forth down to the sort of foot soldiers at the bottom through to a much more networked model in which actually you have a whole array of, you know, pretty much semi-autonomous groups and individuals working together with no single clear boss, but just some people are more powerful and effective than others. Well, in some ways, we might be actually seeing that take place in Russia as well. If Putin shrinks, increasingly, you actually will get other powerful figures who are more interested in working out their own deals rather than feeling that it's all about simply sort of passing money and respect up the chain of command and getting instructions and permissions coming down.
So are we going back to Yeltsin? I guess I'll use that to segue into let's apply this model of how organized crime really works, as opposed to the Hollywood version of how it works, to how Russia worked under... We have three distinct periods I'd put here. I'd put Yeltsin, high Putinism, and now what I'm choosing to call late Putinism. Where is late Putinism going back to Yeltsinism, or was Yeltsinism a different animal in terms of the organized crime metaphor?
Yeltsinism was a different animal because everything was being redefined. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing. It was just suddenly everything was up for grabs. And therefore, the reason why, as it were, both the organized crime wars, but also the struggles within the elite, were that much more vicious, was basically just simply because this was a chance to grab. Now, in a way, we have institutions, we have structures, but more to the point, we also have established senses of who controls what asset and who controls what resource, which, yes, can change. But someone actually has to put effort into changing them rather than just simply people squabbling over the assets that were lying there on the ground.
So Putin, I think we're uniting the five families of New York as an apt metaphor from the Yeltsin to Putin, you think?
Exactly. So you know, high Putinism in this terms would be uniting the five families. What we're seeing now is precisely the different families beginning to wonder actually whether or not this status quo is going to work for them. Because the point is, in a way, you don't necessarily want to be the first person to break with the pack.
Right.
But nor do you want to be the last person.
Is it because that this particular godfather is getting weak, or is it because they want to move to this more networked model? That is kind of the natural order of things that they're going to move to a more networked?
Well, I think it's more that has actually happened. That in a way, you know, with stability comes a natural shift to a slightly more sort of diffuse pattern. In this respect, Putin is a victim of his own successes.
Mm-hmm.
And precisely because they didn't have to be constantly fighting wars and mobilizing resources to do so, which is what the pyramidal model is quite good at. It's good at fighting wars.
Right.
People went their different ways. And in a way, Putin didn't notice because he didn't really care. I mean, as long as no one was challenging him and people were still obeying orders. But when you've got this much more sort of diffuse type of elite, you're going to see much more potential competition. And that's fine in the good times, again, in the high Putinism times when there's ample resources to go around. But it means that when the resources become scarce, it's yet another reason why you're going to see competition and tensions and possibly even conflicts.
Now pull this now into, through the Nemtsov assassination, into where we could be going.
Okay, I mean, we're not heading towards Yeltsinism. Mm-hmm. Or rather, that's perhaps the worst case scenario, but it's not one that I think is at all likely. I mean, instead, I think that actually what we will see is more of the same in terms of what we've just been seeing over the last few weeks, is conflicts that are played out behind the scenes, through leaks, through sort of struggles over particular political and economic resources and so forth. But the point is, it means that increasingly the elite is going to be looking at fighting amongst itself. And what we will see, I think, therefore, is actually a degradation in the capacity for governance. The more that actually the elite are fighting amongst themselves, the less they're actually governing the country.
Hmm. Now, when you bring the society, because there is a society under this mafia, right? And if you look at how a mafia operates in a particular community, in the old, they did bring order to the community. They made sure people in the community were happy. That was part of the deal. What happens in society as we move through these phases here, if you push the metaphor out?
Again, it's the old-style organized crime that tended to operate on that kind of social contract. We will prey on you, and we will brutalize you, but we will also provide you with a degree of protection. We will also provide a certain degree of public services, at least to make you feel that actually we're Cosa Nostra, we're our thing, rather than just purely this evil parasitic force. The network tends to be much, much less able and willing or even interested in building a social contract, because essentially it's a collection of criminal entrepreneurs looking for the next deal. There's no one really there to actually coordinate keeping the population happy. And so what we tend to find is that actually networks are much, much less able to keep populations happy. Now that means that where there's a police force, where there is someone whom you can turn to as an alternative power against the elite, against the criminals, there's a Freudian slip there, then in a way organised crime can sometimes suffer quite badly. But of course we're in a situation now where the networked elite in Russia are less able to provide public service and so forth, or care about it. But at the moment, there isn't yet anyone who can really fight the elite.
Well, no, of course, because if we're applying the mafia metaphor to the state, there is no state to fight, yeah, to fight the mafia. So what does that mean going forward?
Well, I mean, I think increasingly you'll find that, I mean, in a way, it means that the system, you know, operates to a certain extent on inertia, momentum. As long as things are basically fine, you will have flare-ups, you will have bad governance, you'll have more and more cases of sort of embezzlement and such like. But that's okay until something big happens. And, you know, events always will happen eventually. There will be some, you know, major strikes. There will be just a general increase in dissatisfaction within the population. Or maybe there will be some particular sort of political or military or ecological or economic disaster. And then I think you'll suddenly find a state that really has already lost much of its capacity to govern.
And its legitimacy.
Yeah, and that, I think, for me, is a very worrying situation.
Now, where does this leave the Godfather in all of this?
Honestly, this is almost a situation in which actually the Godfather is dead, but no one yet knows it. And in a way, at a certain point, the sons will suddenly start realizing that there's no one in charge.
Do you think that's where we are right now?
We're getting there.
We're getting there. I guess on that note, we will wrap it up, since that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for an enlightening discussion, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
I would also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.